Welcome to League of Moves Podcast. This is Zachary Strebeck, your host and the resident game lawyer. Today, we are talking to game designer Peter Hayward, creator of the recently kickstarted game Scuttle. Welcome, Peter.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
That's great to have you. You reached out to me recently. Turns out you are a listener of the show. Is that true?
Yeah. So I've just, this is my first Kickstarter, and so I needed a business to support it, etc. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, let's do this right. And I remembered seeing your podcast on BoardGameGeek. Mm-hmm. And so I clicked through and listened to the first five or six episodes where you kind of go through bits and pieces about starting it, and then went through and listened to all the ones with the people who I knew.
Okay, great. Was there anyone in particular that you enjoyed the most?
I mean, Jamie Stegmaier is always a delight to listen to.
He's tons of information.
He's a well-spoken gent.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. He embarrasses me. He makes me feel like not a well-spoken person. But all right, so let's talk a little bit about you and your background. So where are you from?
So I'm from Australia, a small continent across the ocean.
Fun fact, a very big continent. Fun fact, it is the only continent and country that is the same thing, right?
And island, is it country as well? I should know this.
It is its own country, and it is its own continent. So it's the only continent that is one country. I don't know, whatever. I shouldn't be talking about this because I'm kind of a moron when it comes to stuff. Also, apparently the snake and spider situation isn't as bad as I thought it was, according to you.
No, so. It's my favorite comparison is it's like guns in America.
Okay.
If you go in and act really dumb and go hunting for them, sure, they can get you. But if you don't know that they're there, you won't notice that it's a huge thing in that country.
Okay, I gotcha. No politics, please. Let's get that. All right, so how did you get into the game industry?
So I have been kind of just creating games for fun since I was a kid. Actually, mostly adapting games my whole life. So have you ever played the game Scumbag or President or various rude words it's also known as? It's a game where you use a standard deck of cards, you deal out cards to everyone, and you're trying to work your way up and down the ranks from round to round.
Hmm.
I don't know what your language policy is.
Yeah, I don't know. We might have our own version. I've played versions of games that are sort of like that.
And so I played that a bunch as a kid and used to play it with other people and just tweaked the rules sort of as I went.
Mm-hmm.
Until I realized that the version I was playing was, it's still essentially the same game, but it had a bunch of just tweaks. And I developed that game before I knew what developing was. To bring optimal fun out of it.
Very cool.
So I've been doing that my whole life. And then about 3 or 4 years ago now, my friend Tom McLean kickstarted a game called Story War, and that did super well. That was made about, I think, $350,000 on Kickstarter. It was his first game. And so I went and helped him out at PAX Australia. He had a booth there, and I kind of assisted with that and just saw like the other tabletop games that exist and sort of got into it through that. Pitched a few game designs to my friend, but he stopped making games. So I just sort of started working on my own stuff and developing and kind of trying to, just made games from there.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that same convention, I met the people from Greater Than Games, Paul, Christopher, and Adam, who run the company Greater Than Games in St. Louis. They make Sentinels of the Multiverse. And so we've sort of kept in touch over the years. And whenever they were in Australia, I'd show them some designs. And when I first came over here, they invited me over and they showed me some of the stuff they were working on. And so, yeah, it's sort of I didn't leap into the games industry. I just sort of leapt into creating stuff and just made a bunch of stuff over a couple of years.
Very cool. So now you are doing a game working with publisher Greater Than Games, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So they actually contacted me. They have always got a dozen games on the go. And last year they did an April Fool's meta campaign, meta games campaign, which was for deck building game and unpub the unpublished card game. This year they wanted to do another one with it. So they ran a game contest, which I helped with the judging of that. And then they were designing the trader mechanic game. And Christopher is one of the world's best game designers. However, he doesn't play social games. So he thought, who do I know? Who have I designed with before? Because I've worked on a few game projects over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And so he called me and said, hey, let's co-design the trader mechanic game because you know social game stuff. And so that's how I got involved with that.
Very cool. So what is it like working with a publisher?
It's great because they were my friends first before they were my publisher, if that makes sense. So it's not like this room of strangers who are, you know, as studio execs kind of frowning down their glasses at me.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who I know and love who are publishing a game that I'm involved with. And so we all want it to be the best game possible.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's very unintimidating because I'm close friends with them before this stuff happened.
Right. One of the cool things about the board game industry, especially, you know, on sort of the lower level, the non-Hasbro Wizards of the Coast level, is how friendly everyone is and how, I don't know, you can sort of be friends with these people who are publishers, yet they also have the power to basically make your career, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess when you're a designer, one of the things you should do is when you go to these conventions and these appearances, you know, you need to be sort of personable, right? I mean, you seem like a personable, affable guy. So I think
I'm actually horrible. I've just turned it on for this podcast interview. As soon as I hang up, I'm going to go back to punching kids in the face and all that kind of lovely. But it's all, you hear this all the time in every industry, but it is really about networking.
Yeah.
Because if someone likes you, they are more likely to look at the stuff that you do, not because they necessarily want to buy it, but because it's a thing that you are excited about. And if they like you, they want to see the stuff that you're excited about.
Yep. So do you find, I know you have a unique look. Would you care to describe it? I'll put a picture of you in the show notes, but.
So I have a blue beard and blue hair.
Yes, you do. I didn't believe it at first. And then I went and watched the Kickstarter video and I was like, okay, there we go. It's good. Do you find that helps you to be more, I guess, memorable or more get people interested in talking with you?
It definitely helps me be more memorable because in this country, I would probably be remembered just as the Australian friendly guy.
Uh-huh.
But as it is, I'm the Australian with a blue hair, with, you know, a blue beard and blue hair, and that is very memorable.
Now, in Australia, are there many people with blue hair and blue beards, or are you still unique there?
Still unique there.
Okay.
Over here, I have the other advantage of being an Australian, and there's not that many Australians over here.
Yes,
so I sort of have a dual advantage with that. I was at PAX Australia last year, 2015, and it's sort of a double-edged sword sometimes because probably close to 35 people came up to me and said hi, who I just didn't know who they were. They were either people who I'd interacted with online, and because I'm, as you said, quite distinctive, they knew who I was, or they're people who I'd met maybe for a couple of minutes in a previous year, or people I'd met in America. But yeah, all these people came up and said, hey, Peter, how's it going? How's Scuttle going? How's Dracula's Feast? How's your various games?
Awesome.
And I was like, great, great. I tried to hide it because it's never nice to find that someone doesn't know who you are at all. But I was also like, God, please introduce yourself a little bit. Just give me something, something to latch onto.
I know what you mean. I have tons of adoring fans that are always coming up to me and I can't remember them all.
Are you that podcasting lawyer? And you're like, yes.
I did. The only time people have recognized me in public is last year at Gen Con. I think I had taken part in a Dice Tower stream a couple days before Gen Con. And so people were coming up to me and saying, hey, you're the lawyer. I know you, which was pretty cool. I've never been recognized in real life. It was pretty exciting.
That's pretty fun.
Yeah.
I was just at Who's Your Con in Indianapolis this last weekend. And I had someone come up and recognize me from the Kickstarter video, which was both fun and also made sense. Like they introduced themselves as, hey, I've backed your Kickstarter, which was very lovely of them to say and do. But it immediately gave me a context and I was like, great, I understand who you are and that I shouldn't feel bad for not having.
Yeah, it's weird when people sort of come up to you and go, hey, how's it going? Like you don't know who they are. And I mean,
yeah.
No, go on.
Fortunately, people generally are open with questions, so I can kind of answer that question and keep the conversation going from there.
Very cool.
Whereas if they came up and said, hey, Peter, ask me a question, I would be in trouble.
Yes. All right, let's talk about Kickstarter. So you currently have a Kickstarter going on as of today. There are 25 days left. When this goes up, it'll be 23, I think. So let's tell me a little bit about your take on the Kickstarter process.
So the game is called Scuttle. Earlier on, I was saying that I used to develop games accidentally. There's a two-player card game called Cuttle. You just use a normal deck of playing cards. When my sister and I were kids, we found it online and we just loved it. We probably played, definitely hundreds of games of Cuttle at this point. And again, we played it and played it and played it. And then probably three or four years ago, I went back to the website where the rules are and realized that over the course of the years, we'd actually tweaked a lot of the rules quite substantially. Just little things to streamline it and that. And so when my intent is to start a company. So on my to-do list is to go through and listen to your interview with Teal Fristo.
Yes.
They did it a few months back.
Because the dogs are going crazy. Hold on. Dogs, relax. Okay, dogs. I apologize. This is a complete disaster here. Usually I'm dog sitting for the week, so I Crazy dogs here. So you want to meet or listen to Teal Fristo's interview? Yes.
Yeah, so on my list of things to do is go back and listen to your interview with Teal Fristo from a few months ago, because she talks about Teal, if you're listening. He talks about using Kickstarter to kind of kickstart a small company, which is very much my intent. So Jelly Bean Games is the name of my company. The intent is to make games for families, because quite often I know a lot of gamer parents. Like, there's been a huge rise of gaming lately, and with that comes gamer parents. Yep. And I know a lot of gamer parents who want to play games with their kids. However, most games are either overwhelming for the kids or really boring for the adults.
Yeah.
It's hard to find that kind of sweet spot, and that's where Jelly Bean Games lands. So Scuttle is an adaptation of this old game I used to play as a kid, because it's very simple. Every turn you either draw a card or play a card, and cards are either treasure or actions. That's it. First person to 21 treasure wins. That right there is basically the whole thing.
Prior to starting your Kickstarter, what sort of resources did you consult, since this is your first Kickstarter?
So I am very much the kind of person who, before I start something, I want to read everything I can find on the subject. So I went through to Jamie Stegmeier's website, kickstarterlessons.com, and I think I've read every post on there at least three times. Like, I just devoured that entire site. And as well as that, there's a bunch more now, but I started kind of looking into this whole process about a year ago. And so I read through all of James Matthews' stuff and Jamie Stegmeier's stuff and everyone that Jamie Stegmeier links to, and just, a thousand blogs. And then, like I said, I looked up your podcast because I'd seen it around, and I wanted to make sure I did everything by the book. And so I just, tried to read everything that I could find on the subject.
Excellent. That's exactly what I tell people to do. The other one would be Richard Bliss's podcast, Funding the Dream.
Oh, yeah, Funding the Dream. That's great.
Yep.
Plus, I had the advantage of being friends with the Greater Than Games guys. And they've run a billion Kickstarters over the years. And so I would be able to shoot them ideas and questions and get feedback on that from people who have been through it quite successfully before.
Excellent. So assuming you learned some lessons, how did you go about marketing your Kickstarter, building your community and all of that?
So that's probably the part that I'm worst at because I read all the stuff about, try to comment on blogs and send emails to people, but I'm just not a natural blog commenter. Now that Kickstarter's started, weirdly enough, I find myself doing it a bit more because I have direct experience to talk about, and I want to share that. I started a business website about the process at beard.blue.
Yes, I like that address.
Perfect for me. And so I tried to do some stuff on there, but I've just been so overwhelmed. I haven't been able to make it consistently update, which is what you're meant to do. But there is some information up there. Fortunately, because I've lived in a bunch of different places all over Australia and traveled a lot, and I'm fairly distinctive and memorable, I have sort of a community already, in that I have, I think, 1,500 Facebook friends, including a bunch of people who will click through to my page just to see what I'm up to, because I'm always having adventures. And so that was a huge boost. On day one, I kind of posted there, and a lot of my friends, even people who didn't necessarily want the game, they backed it for a dollar. And that sort of backer surge on day one, even if it's not a massive financial surge, but that backer surge, I think, drew it to the attention of Kickstarter. And it's a very pretty game. My artist, Kelly Jo, she does incredible work. This is her first time doing art for a tabletop game, so she really put her all into it. And it's just such a distinctive looking and pretty game that
looks great.
A bunch of people, they click through and they're like, oh, that's great. People like pretty games, it turns out. But as well as that, Kickstarter likes pretty games. So they put me on the new and noteworthy straight away and gave me a project we love, I think, on the first day, which is super useful for that. So I didn't really market and build a community as effectively as I should have, but because I sort of have a community of my friends, which sound, everyone has a community of their friends, but I have friends in three different countries and I've known a bunch of people. And I sent an email to my family and I have, I think, 28 cousins on one side. So I have quite an extended family. And so a lot of my family members backed it, which is lovely as well.
Excellent. So knowing what you know now, I mean, obviously I wouldn't counsel other Kickstarter creators to rely on Kickstarter themselves putting you on the front page, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So what do you think you would have done different?
I mean, it's gone so well.
How do you think you could have done it better, I guess? I mean, I understand maybe you don't feel like you're the type of person that would comment on blogs, but I don't know. Do you kind of have to force yourself to do it and have things to talk about?
Like I said, so rather than what would I do again, what am I going to do next time?
Sure.
I can answer, because next time I'm going to make sure that the art is super pretty. Like, art was going to be a priority, but looking at how much it's helped Scuttle, I'm actually hiring a friend of mine to do the art for my second game. She's ex-Disney. Mm-hmm. Her name is Tanya Walker. You can find her at tanyawalker.com. She does gorgeous stuff. And she's doing the art for Dracula's Feast in a kind of Edward Gorey, you know, pink crosshatchy kind of style. Very cool. So good. And so that's the thing that I got. If your art looks cheap, I think people are going to get less excited about the game. Whereas on a Kickstarter, the first thing they can see is that the main thing I would have done differently is had a print and play on the front page of the Kickstarter from day one.
Mm. Okay.
Which I'm planning to do, hopefully, too. My artist is sort of doing 15 things at once at the moment. But if we can get a print and play up, I think that's something that that you should try to do right from the start. But yeah. I made sure to have reviews. I made sure to have a bunch of stuff like that ready when the Kickstarter launched, which is stuff I learned from Jamie Stegmaier's blog.
Yep, absolutely. And and it's all part of the laying the groundwork before you you get into actually launching your campaign. As far as your artist goes, I mean, whatever you can talk about is fine. How does your deal work out in that respect? Only because, you know, you have to have great art, but you also have to have money to buy great art usually. So,
my story might not be helpful to listeners because I... As it turns out, I'm just the luckiest person in the world.
Yes.
The first time I came to America, the third day after I'd landed in New York, I wandered into a cafe and started chatting to people there. And one person, it turned out, was my friend Kelly Jo, who was an artist. And I told her about my idea for Scuttle. And she said, okay, I'm doing the art. And I said, yep, that is great. I will pay you this much. And she's like, nope, I don't want to get paid for it. I want a percentage of the Kickstarter and a percentage of game sales. And that's very unusual. Like that's not a standard deal. Yeah. But because I designed the game, I didn't have to pay a designer a percentage of royalties. So we worked out a deal because she wanted to feel more invested in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to, she wanted to have this as an ongoing thing instead of a one lump kind of sum. So I paid $0 up front for my art, which is hugely unusual. However, she's getting a percentage of the Kickstarter and a percentage of royalties going forward.
Well, it may be slightly unusual. It basically comes back to what you were talking about before, about the importance of networking, right? And
absolutely.
Getting yourself in front of these people. You called it luck, but in my experience, it's, you can sort of direct yourself to make that luck, right? You went there and you actually talked to people. I mean, but if you go to conventions and places, you know, even like art-based conventions? I don't know what they have. But
yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, a lot of board games, like Gen Con has an artist alley these days. And if you see someone doodling, sit down and chat to them. I mean, sit down and chat to them if you're going to have a good time. Don't randomly harass strangers. But
right. There's parties. There's tons of forums for art as well. Board Game Geek has them. DeviantArt exists.
Absolutely.
There's so many avenues where you can actually reach out and talk with artists and make yourself known.
And even if you can't be physically present, Twitter is a great, great resource for that. I've signed a game by a game designer called Daniel Newman. It's going to be my third project. I've got plans for this company, as you can tell.
That's great.
And he's a great designer. It's a really fun game. It's called Tomb of Doom. But he, aside from that, he uses Twitter better than anyone I've ever seen. It's amazing.
So explain.
He replies to tweets with the right questions and he likes stuff and all that. What were you saying, sir?
No, I've seen you to explain the way to use Twitter because I don't
know. Oh, right.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah. So for example, I'm going to pull it up now because he does such a good job on it. His username is Daniel Newman with all of the vowels taken out. So DNLNWMN.
All right.
And every time someone he follows posts something that he has an interesting question, he'll ask it. It's as simple as that.
So
I'm just trying to find an example. He's just like someone talked about their job at game with gaming and he said, how would you describe what you do in games? Like, tell me more about that. And that person replies, then he replies back. And soon, you're in a conversation with someone.
Yep.
And I know that he talks with Jamie Stegmaier on Twitter all the time and he talks with other big designers and people who are in companies, and people just kind of know him because he is a friendly, chatty guy who asks you questions that you're actually interested in replying.
Yeah, it's interesting. And Twitter seems like a sort of an odd place to do that only because of the limitations on the length of replies. But I guess if you ask a relatively direct question, that can have a succinct answer.
So if someone says, I saw Batman versus Superman, he won't reply with something that requires a bunch of effort, like, what are your five favorite superhero films? He'd be like, oh yeah, I really enjoyed that. What did you think of this scene? And that inspires a conversation because quite often people will have opinions on this scene or that scene or specific kind of things. And then as well as that, when you do something fun, he'll retweet it and kind of celebrate with you. And you're like, hey, Daniel Newman's in my corner. It's so pleasant. I really enjoy watching him. And I, like you said, I'm a fairly outgoing person, but not necessarily online. And watching him has made me be like, I should do that more. He's so good at it.
Yeah, I'm always jealous of the people that sort of maybe have the time to do that. I don't usually have that or the drive. I guess I could find the time if I really wanted to. But
so I tend to check Twitter when I'm standing in queues and stuff like that. Right. That's a really good time to do it. Just as you're scrolling through, if you see anything that triggers a question, just reply. But yeah, my point is that networking doesn't have to be done in person. You don't have to fly to New York and walk into cafes to find artists.
Absolutely.
If you're chatting with people, then yeah, it just gives you a pre-existing relationship.
I agree. So what about forming LLCs or companies or anything like that? Have you done any kind of the business side of the legal work?
So I did exactly what my friend Paul Bender recommended. Paul Bender runs Greater Than Games. Okay. And I hired a lawyer and got them to do all that so it would all be done exactly right, especially because I'm not from America. I wanted to make sure everything was done completely by the book.
Right. Very good.
And so that cost a little bit of money up front, but it also means that now I have a lawyer. And so when I need to put a contract together, instead of hobbling it together myself, I'll just send her an email and be like, hey, these are the expectations from my end. These are the expectations of the designer. And she'll put it into legalese and send it back.
Great.
And then I can kind of use that as a boilerplate contract for future works.
Obviously, it hurts a little bit that you didn't contact me, but that's okay. Totally fine. You're forgiven. No problem. What about the costs of creating the game? So did you contact manufacturers or do any kind of research beforehand to determine what you should be setting the reward levels at?
Yeah, so I did so much research.
Perfect answer.
I contacted a million different manufacturers, literally a million. I can send you the emails. But the one thing I read actually that I thought was super interesting was that when you contact a manufacturer, make sure you know what you're asking before you send the email, because if you have to go back and forth three or four times before the project even starts, a lot of manufacturers will be like, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, and they'll kind of just stop replying and drop you. And so, yeah, that's my big piece of advice, because I did that with one manufacturer that I was really keen on, and they just sort of stopped replying. And then I read this piece being like, oh, that's what I did. And so, yeah, make sure you know what your plan is before you go into the emailing, because if you have to go back and forth and be like, okay, what if it was 46 cards or what if it was a slightly different this or that, or whatever, then that it's just not worth anyone's time. It's genuinely not worth their time to deal with you, and you spend a lot of time trying to find new manufacturers because that one won't deal with you.
Sure. Now, as far as what you're talking about, do you mean specifically what the pieces that you want in the game are going to be, or just maybe the general manufacturing process and things about that?
So generally, try to get a quote from a manufacturer. Don't try to get six quotes from a manufacturer.
Yeah.
The first time I contacted one, I said, how much for this many cards in a tuck box? And they replied. I said, okay, what if it was a telescoping box?
Okay.
And they replied. And then I said, okay, what if I split it into two things and had one top, I just kept on going and going with different amounts and different things because I was interested and I was curious. And so I just wanted to know the information, but they were obviously like, this guy is not worth replying to. And quite fairly, he stopped replying to me.
Well, I mean, they extrapolate those three questions before you've even started anything into the future relationship. Right. And so for 8 months, you're going to be sending them questions daily and asking them a million questions, and nobody has time for that, unfortunately. Yep. Yeah.
It's the 80-20 rule. I would become part of the 80% that is not worth most of the 20%
absolutely
of their time.
It's unfortunate, but it's true. So I would recommend that first-time developers especially really understand basically everything about manufacturing, right? I mean, and
there's so much reading you can do online.
Yeah,
like everything that I emailed them to ask, you can find online.
Yep.
And I don't have time to do this, but I would love it if someone put out a thing being like, generally, this is what you'd expect to pay for this. Like, if there was a website somewhere that you could find a table that was, 54 cards in a 2000 print run with a tuck box, this is generally what you'll expect to pay. That would have saved me a bunch of time. And obviously, it's not going to be 100% correct, and you still need to get a quote before you go to Kickstarter. But something like that would be super useful. That's a resource I wish existed. I'm not saying I have it.
Don't some of them have, I mean, I don't generally go through this process myself, but don't some of them have sort of an online form that you can fill out or something that will give you some sort of quote?
No, generally it's the online form that goes to the email address.
And they send you an actual quote.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Well, the big thing for me was shipping, because I know that shipping is what generally takes Kickstarter creators out.
Yes.
I've backed so many Kickstarters and had gotten so many updates being like, oh God, we really underestimated shipping costs. Yes. And so before I went live, because a lot of my fan base, my friends are in Australia, I really wanted to make sure I had affordable Australian shipping, and that is not easy. Because I wanted to have it all shipped to America and go to distributors over here, I really needed to make sure it was affordable to have that happen and then ship it to Australia.
Okay.
And so I spent probably close to a week just on comparing shipping costs. And that's where it was really helpful to have friends who ship stuff out all the time at Greater Than Games, because I was able to be like, okay, would this work? Would that work? And unlike a manufacturer, they didn't stop replying to emails because they are beholden to be friends with me. And so, yeah, after about 4 or 5 days, I finally worked out a reliable way to get shipping down, and that helped me work out my shipping costs.
Very good. But those 4 or 5 days are well worth the time taken, right? Because later you're going to...
Well, because my goal for this Kickstarter was $3,000, and I thought I would probably go above five, but I wanted to be really safe and go 3,000. And we're in... Tomorrow is going to be the 2 week since it launched, and we just hit $24,000.
Very cool.
So had I made a mistake on shipping...
Yeah, it just extrapolates your mistake.
Yeah, a mistake on shipping with a $3,000 campaign means, oh, well, I'm a little bit out of pocket. Mistake with shipping on a because when it ends, this is probably going to be upwards of $30,000. I'm not trying to sound immodest. I'm just saying it. I've got 25 days to go, and I'm at $24,000. It's likely I'll end above $30,000.
Yep.
And so that same shipping mistake, which could have been, you know, $500, would now be $5,000.
Yep.
That I could be out of pocket.
I agree. Yeah. And, you know, and it may be worth it to become a part of the community and start asking other developers what they've done as far as this goes, right?
Yeah. So I'm friends with the guys who run Cardboard Edison, which is the best aggregator of board game news. Every week they put out a list of here is all the posts about board game each week, and here's a bunch of podcasts and stuff like that. Amazing stuff. And the day that I launched, I got an email from them being like, Peter, your page looks great. We saw your shipping cost is really low and we're worried. We want to make sure that you know what you're doing.
Right.
And so I was able to assure them that I did. But run your preview page, ideally through a few of the Facebook groups. And there's a bunch of really useful Facebook groups that are very receptive and offer a lot of feedback. Mm-hmm. And that way, they, you know, any massive blunders like that, you can hopefully get pointed out to you before you click launch.
Very good advice. That's great.
I feel like I'm being very preachy. Here's what you should do.
No, that's great. I mean, that's what people want to know, because so many developers, even though all this information that's out there, people don't necessarily know where to find it, or there's so much information that you don't know which is the one you're supposed to be listening to, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the best way to go about it is find human beings that you can trust that have done this before and ask them, what is the advice I need to listen to?
Absolutely.
Because anyone can say anything on the internet.
And they do.
Yes, they do. So they it's important that you are listening to the right people.
There's so much information out there, and I really recommend cardboardedison.com. I back them on Patreon because they just provide such a resource in that. I was talking with them about how that got started, and they used to hunt around for all this information just for themselves because they're board game designers. They have a couple of excellent games that I've played. And so they were like, look, we're doing all this research anyway. We're making these lists just for ourselves. We might as well send it out. And now it's just an invaluable resource. I can't believe how they are.
Very cool. What about finding artists? I know that you mentioned a Disney artist. How did you find them for your next
game? So that is also part of having a network. She I met Tanya in 2008 when I bought a fridge off her in Brisbane. She now lives in Tasmania. Okay. I'm not even in Australia anymore. But when I saw Kickscuttle doing well and I thought, I want my next game to look really gorgeous, I immediately thought, who do I know who has worked with Disney? And that would be Tanya.
Okay.
And so I got in contact with her, and it turns out she's a huge tabletop gamer. She knows more about role-playing games than I think anyone I've ever met. And she happened to be looking to sort of hopefully turn her artistic work in that direction. So I got into contact with her, and she was super excited about it. She's actually working on the art for a few of my upcoming games, because like I said, I've got plans. I've got big plans for the future. But yeah, so I contacted her, and we went back and forth a few times to make sure we're on the same page about stuff. And then it turned out we were. She was, super excited and super keen to be involved. But outside of that, I mean, there's so much good art. There's been a few times when I've just looked at a game and been just thought this game is gorgeous. If you can afford to pay for art up front, I know a lot of artists will do, you know, some up front, some after the Kickstarter funds, stuff like that.
Right.
But if you can afford to get at least a few pieces up front, it's really worth it. It's really worth getting good art. And just look at games that you like. Maybe not, you know, big games, but there's so much stuff coming out all the time. Look at stuff like that. So there's a game by Scott Alms called Best Treehouse Ever, Green Couch Games. And I adore the art style on that. I just think it's absolutely gorgeous. So I got in contact with Adam McIver, who does the art for that, and went back and forth with him. But, you know, all of the art that you like on games was made by someone. You know, someone made that. Get in contact with them. At worst, you won't get a reply, although they won't be able to. But if you try enough people and you're able to pay for good art, because in order to get really good art, you do have to pay for it.
Sure.
You will find an artist that, you know, you will eventually find someone who can do it and will do it.
Yeah. A recent guest, Dave Burke, he runs Hemisphere Games, and they recently did the Karmica Kickstarter, and the art in that is amazing.
So pretty.
Yeah, it looks great. I met the artist whose name escapes me now at PAX South, and it was great. I mean, they had prints of his art.
Yeah. And so if you might not be able to afford them, or they might not have time in the schedule, but if you get in contact with them, you know, at worst it'll be a no, and at best you'll get the amazing art from the amazing artists who you admire.
Right. Well, often these artists are working in some sort of artistic job, and they're working with other people who are also presumably super talented, maybe don't have any experience in games but want some, or they love playing games and maybe they would love to be part of a game design crew. You never know.
Absolutely.
It never hurts to ask, right?
And as well as that, there are, again, Facebook groups. Yep. Once you get into one Facebook group, you kind of get the idea that there's others, and there's some that are dedicated just to tabletop game art. Mm-hmm. That's the entire focus. My friend Cy from Melbourne, he runs a great one. I think it's called Art and Graphic Design for Tabletop, something like that. And it's just great. Like, I'm in that group not because I'm an artist, but because I love seeing all the gorgeous art pop up, and I kind of sometimes note down names and go, oh, well, if I have a game in this kind of style, I know that this person can do that style.
Right.
That would be awesome.
Very cool. So any tips for someone who's developing their first board game? Other tips than obviously all the treasure trove of tips you've already given.
The big one for me, I got a great Kickstarter message the other day from someone who said, hey, Peter, I see that this is your first game on Kickstarter. It's doing really well. I want to put my game up on Kickstarter. How do you recommend I do that? And I said, well, the first thing I recommend is, because I like I said, I've been playing Cuddle since I was a kid, and I started properly developing it for Kickstarter over a year ago. And so I said to them, if this is your first game, don't make it with Kickstarter in mind. Make it with being a good game in mind, because probably your first game isn't going to be. And I don't say that as an insult. Maybe you're the exception and your first game is amazing. But I've got probably 10 games that I designed that I look at now, and I just think, what was I doing? Like, none, I mean, that's how you get good at games.
Right.
So what I told them, sorry?
Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I told them was, take your game, find a local gaming group, and start playtesting with that group. Put it in front of people you don't know. Again, there are Facebook groups for this. There are Facebook groups for everything. I know people who are like, I don't want to be on Facebook. And that's great. But for a lot of this stuff, it's so useful for resources, just resources alone. Get it in front of people you don't know, who aren't your friends, who aren't your family, and have them tear it to shreds. And it is a disheartening process. But once you've got a game that, I mean, and there are games that, you know, some people will never like your game. That's just how game design works. But you want to make sure that you've made a game that someone loves. Dracula's Feast is my second game coming out, hopefully in the next 6 months or so on Kickstarter. And that was the first game that I made that people played it when I wasn't there. And that's what you're after. So I remember reading an article with the guy who designed Dominion, Donald X. Vaccarino,
yeah.
Vaccarino. And he said that he realized he was onto something with Dominion when people were asking him to pull it out and play it.
Right.
And that's what you're after. So you can design a perfectly functional game. That's great. And you can probably make some money on Kickstarter, and people will buy it and be like, that was a perfectly functional game. But if you want to continue doing games and continue doing Kickstarters, you've got to make games that people will love. And the only way to do that, in my mind, is make games that are bad until you make games that are good.
No, that's basically how it works. Even in video games, it's the same thing. And try to keep those bad games to be very small in scope, right? So you can sort of get through that process quickly. get all those bad games out of the way and then start making the good ones.
If you make a game that takes 3 hours to playtest, it's going to take you 3 years to get to the same point as a game that takes 5 minutes to playtest.
Yep.
Just in pure scope of designing and playtesting.
Speaking of playtesting, if anyone is in the San Jose area, San Jose, California, that is, in I think it's April 15th, 16th, and 17th, I will be at the Protospiel event run by Jeremy Commander. You can check out information about that on boardgamebuilders.com. I think I'm some sort of VIP guest, which is weird. But
that's super cool.
Yeah. Feel free to fly out here.
You have a podcast now, so
yes, I'm a big deal, kind of. Not really.
my advice to first time board game developers is make more games, make more bad games.
Yeah.
Throw them into the wolves and have them torn apart in front of you, and then go home and cry and make a better game.
Well, at some point, then, they're going to stop tearing it apart, right? And they're going to start enjoying it. Yeah.
It actually happens. Yeah. And I was so amazed the first time that I made a game and watched people not struggling to play it, but actually playing it. Right. Which sounds dumb, but it's such a difference when people have gone from being like, oh, that guy with the blue beard has bought another game. Sure, we'll play that for him. Mm-hmm. To like, oh, okay, I think I want to do this, and this is how I do it, and this is how the game works. Right. And nothing can replace actually watching people play the game. So I really strongly recommend not actually playing the game, but always just watching people play.
Sure.
And if someone's struggling, don't step forward and be like, here's what you should do. Like, If no one's having a good time and you can fix that, absolutely fix that. But watch people not have a good time, and that will really motivate you to make sure that next time you bring them something, they have a good time.
Makes perfect sense.
So I told this guy, do that. Get back to me in 6 months' time, because that is realistically how long it's going to take to be sure that you have a game that's worth making. And then I will tell you the next step. So if you're listening to this, and you want more advice from me specifically, do that and then email me in 6 months' time, and I'll happily tell you the next step after that.
Very good. I'll have you back on. How about that?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. That's going to do it for this episode. I think we're basically out of time. So thank you again for coming on the show, Peter.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
Where can our listeners find you?
So I am the best place to find me at the moment during the campaign is at scuttlegame.com, which will take you to my Kickstarter campaign. I am on Twitter as Peter C. Haywood, H-A-Y-W-A-R-D.
Okay.
But my content is not always about board games. I've sort of got my finger in a few different pies. So I recommend following me. I'm great. But don't be surprised if you see stuff that is unrelated to what I was talking about today.
No problem. I just hit 800 followers. I'm so excited. This is a big deal.
Very exciting. Someone made fun of me for not having many followers. So if you're listening to this, come and follow.
I will be following you right after this episode, so don't worry.
Oh, there we go.
You can follow me and read me at gameblurblog.com, and go on iTunes and put a 5-star review for the show. Lastly, I'd like to do, maybe on the next episode or the one after, a listener Q&A episode. So possibly I'm going to get another game lawyer on here. So if listeners have any questions that they'd like answered on the show, non-specific legal questions, how about that? So don't ask me specifically about your specific trademark, but ask me about trademarks in general, and I will answer it. So email the questions to, I guess, admin@legalmovespodcast.com, or tweet them to me at Z Striebeck on Twitter. All right, and that's it.
I realized that I already had my time to plug, but I just remembered something else.
Go for it.
I do a podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so if people enjoyed listening to my Australian accent, I do a podcast with my ex-fiance. It's called Being Honest With My Ex, and you can find it at beinghonestwithmyex.com.
Very cool.
Totally ruined your outro structure.
No,
Zach.
Don't worry about that. It really just goes until I stop talking, and then I put the outro music on. So don't worry. All right. I will see you all next week, listeners.